Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. In a few days, it'll be five years since Katrina hit the coast and almost decimated entire cities and for all intents and purposes, destroyed entire neighborhoods in New Orleans. It's a very familiar story by now, but maybe not so familiar are the stories behind the story, the people who stayed. And joining us now is Greg Jacobs. He co-produced and wrote Witness Katrina, which airs tonight on the National Geographic Channel. The Witness to Katrina is a series of mostly amateur video and commentary from the folks who stayed. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thanks so much for having me.
You reviewed some 500 hours of video footage. How did you decide what to leave out?
Well, it was not an easy process, and it's really a tribute to our amazing editor, Katerina Simic. It was 500 hours of video footage and another 200 hours or so of audio. And we figured out that if she had watched and listened to that material for 8 hours a day and done nothing else, it would have taken her 4 months just to get through it. And we only had 6 months to make the show. So she kind of culled it down as she was going through it, you know, sort of like writing a book as you're starting the research. And so there was just so much to, you know, to leave in or leave out, mm-hmm. and so much that, you know, we wish we could have gotten in there. But in the end, you know, we wanted something that really told a coherent story and I think, you know, hopefully rivets people to a story that they may feel is familiar and in this context is not.
At first, when we were watching it last night, we were like, wow, 2 hours. And then the next thing you know, it was over with. There's very little narration.
Right. We had done a show 2 years ago called 102 Minutes That Changed America, where we essentially reconstructed the morning of 9/11 in New York City in real time using only amateur and kind of the forgotten footage from networks, that kind of thing. And so we realized that that show got a wonderful reaction, and we realized that there are probably other events, not many, but some that could handle that kind of treatment. So we went to National Geographic and said, hey, we could do this with Hurricane Katrina. And they, I think, saw the possibilities right away. It's once you strip the narration away and you just leave it as the story of the people as they're experiencing it, it really becomes a completely different experience for the viewer. And you sort of feel like you are living it with them. And in a sense, you are seeing a story that is from these people and not just about them. And it's very, very different from, I think, the way people are used to seeing it.
My guest is Greg Jacobs. He's one of the producers of Witness Katrina. It will air tonight on the National Geographic Channel. Let's listen to a bit from it now. In St. Bernard Parish, a woman tries to rescue her dog, Hop, as all of the furniture floats by in her house.
Come on, Hop! She's trying to get on the table and can't. Oh, God, what else broke?
I'll have more.
Just a little bit higher than the last time I told you. Hop, come! Oh, God, Faye, I think she drowned it.
I'll tell you, that really choked me up when I watched it last night. Because
yeah.
You don't resolve it immediately. You don't know. You do pick some families to follow, though.
Yeah, I mean, people had various reasons for staying and for having the camera around. And, you know, in some cases it was, oddly enough, because they had the camera out because they just wanted to document it before the storm for the insurance people.
Mm-hmm.
So once the storm starts, the camera becomes something that, you know, is there either to show somebody in their family, you'll never believe this, or just to get control of the situation. So in that case, that was Fabian and Pam Guerra. And, you know, he kept filming throughout this experience, and so did she. And they end up essentially, you know, when the storm passes on their rooftop. And the first hour of the show ends with Fabian saying, turning the camera on himself and saying, I've made a lot of mistakes in my time, but this one is the worst. I will, next time there's a hurricane, I will run.
You're a professional. What impression did all these amateur filmmakers make on your work?
Well, in this structure, in this format, which is, you know, unique, it's not an easy thing to put together.
Mm-hmm.
It almost flips the normal paradigm of what a good shot is on its head. So typically people are looking for great shots, you know, shots that are especially dramatic or show something very clearly. And what ends up happening is the networks take those shots and they put them on one tape and then they ship those tapes out. And so you end up kind of seeing the same great shots over and over again. And for us, we're actually looking for the bad shots, the stuff that's, you know, would be otherwise unusable, things where it's shaking or maybe the cameraman is walking and the camera is still on, or, you know, because what we're interested in is the camera kind of as an expression of the person behind it. And so this amateur footage is perfect for us because you are hearing the emotions of the people as they're filming. And so it's almost like you're in their brain. And it doesn't really matter what it looks like. And in some ways, the more raw it is, the better it is, and the more powerful it is for us.
The story starts a few days before the storm hit. It's very chronological.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't do kind of like a flashback thing or anything like that.
Yeah, it is important to us to really have the experience unfold as the people are experiencing it. There's no after-the-fact interviews. There's no talking heads. There's nothing except maybe the tiny bit of narration that's in there that will pull you out of the moment. And, you know, these shows, in a way, depend on what people understand and know about the event, or at least what they think they know about the event. So you, when you see at the very beginning a hurricane party the night before the storm hits, and there are people who they're drinking and they're partying and they're sort of making light of the storm because that's what they do in New Orleans. It's just a tradition. But the audience, you know, brings an understanding of what's to come. And it really holds you in your seat, I think, because you sort of have to stick around and see what you know is going to happen.
Right. We have another cut I want to listen to. It's a nurse. She's describing the dire situation at Charity Hospital. It's a teaching hospital in New Orleans.
So this is desperation. We're talking about siphoning gas from an ambulance. Well, siphoning diesel because we have 4 gallons of diesel left for the rest of the hospital, pretty much, for the everything that needs to be on life support. We have maybe till daylight. After that, we have nothing at all. Zero energy. The ICUs have no ventilators, so all their patients will, who knows what will happen to them.
You know, Greg, when I've been there, been to New Orleans a couple times, 3 times since, and, you know, got one of those tours of the destroyed areas. And what finally sunk into me, I think, during one of those tours was how cut off people were from each other, that even a hospital like Charity Hospital, they didn't know when help was coming.
Yeah. I mean, I'm so glad you picked that clip to show because that's one of my favorite pieces of footage in the whole show.
Yeah.
I think what the moment that really gets me there is that she says something to the effect of, you know, the patients, and then she pauses and catches herself, you know, she doesn't know who's going to watch this footage,
right?
But she catches herself not wanting to say what she knows, which is the rest of the sentence is the patients are all going to die. And so she, just before saying that, she's a nurse and she's incredibly positive, unbelievably so throughout this. So she says instead, well, who knows what will happen to them? And, you know, it's sort of you're watching somebody who is facing really the worst situation they can possibly imagine and trying to get through it. So it's an incredible just a piece of emotional footage for me.
How did you find all the footage for this? It had to take a lot of time to track it down.
Yeah, I mean, they're all different ways. That one was an interesting one because that woman, Erin, the nurse in that clip, she emailed out of the blue and said, you know, I was a nurse at Charity Hospital and I have some footage. Would you be interested? And, you know, of course we are. So I emailed her back and then didn't hear from her. And I emailed several times and didn't hear from her. So I didn't want to just bother her. So I gave up. But I couldn't stand it. I just, you know, I had to find it. So about 3 or 4 months later, I decided I'm going to see if I can track her down on Facebook. And so I sent her a message through Facebook. And she got back to me right away and said her email had been hacked, so she had to cancel that account. And, of course, she's happy to give us the footage. It's just, you know, there's a lot of persistence that goes into it. But basically, you know, it's detective work, just phone call after phone call. You hear about something and somebody mentions, oh, yeah, I think my buddy had a camera. And you call that person and he says, I didn't, but my neighbor did. And eventually, you know, you've got 500 hours.
What were people doing with the video otherwise?
Well, it's a real mix. Some of the people, we had a wonderful producer down in New Orleans, Rebecca Snedeker, who she really knew the lay of the land. She had worked a lot with Archive, knew the film community inside and out. And so, you know, she started with those people, the people who were professionals and had professional, you know, motives for going out. So they were, in some ways, the trickiest ones because they maybe thought, they understood the value of it, and maybe they wanted to make their own documentaries. And so they, you know, that took a little bit of persuading, understanding that the historical value of having their footage be part of this larger picture. But in general, you know, once you call the people, they're really happy to have their story told. And they feel like the rest of the country has maybe either forgotten about them or has kind of absorbed a narrative that they don't really agree with. So the fact that this particular format is going to let their footage tell the story by itself, I think really appealed to people.
I love at the end when the one fellow, he's driving to California in his pickup truck, and he's still videotaping himself, and he's singing a song with a Tipperillo clenched between his teeth, and he eventually returned to New Orleans. But what was the point of that scene to you?
Well, there are moments of New Orleans-ness that pop out every once in a while. I mean, one of the things that I love is that this is very much not about the mythological New Orleans. These are just normal people, an incredibly diverse spectrum of normal people in a city that just is a city.
Mm-hmm.
But every once in a while, something very New Orleans pops out, and that was one of the purposes of having Shelton basically start singing a spiritual as he's driving out west, having had to evacuate. And you know, it was a way of kind of reminding that you people that you can maybe take the person out of New Orleans, or you can force the person out of New Orleans, but you definitely can't take the New Orleans out of them. And so to me, it's very moving that he is singing the song as he's leaving the city, and then you find out that he did return soon afterwards.
And it was a wonderful angle, and it was great sound.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a very cool angle.
It's true. I mean, that's one of the other funny things about all this amateur footage is every once in a while, they do something that is so perfect. So, you know, we appreciate that, too.
In some cases, there was resolution at the end. There's very little narration, but you did have some type that went along with it. But in others, the story is left undone. You don't reiterate the Superdome aftermath. You don't talk about what happened at Charity Hospital.
Yeah, we really, you know, the rule for something like this is to follow the footage.
Okay.
And, you know, one thing that you forget is that so much of this material depends on something as simple as batteries. So the kind of material that we had during the storm and the first couple of days of the storm, you don't have it as much afterwards because people don't have power and they can't recharge their batteries. So you end up with mostly news footage there, and that footage kind of has a sameness to it. You know, they're down there for a reason, and they're down there to get their particular stories. And so the footage doesn't quite feel as spontaneous and personal. So I think that's one of the reasons why we decided to kind of end it in a sort of unfinished way. You know, we can let other documentaries or other books take over from there.
Okay, Greg, that's all the time we have in this segment. Greg Jacobs, producer and writer on Witness Katrina. It airs tonight on the National Geographic Channel. Greg, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me.
You bet. We'll be right back. If you'd like to have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. When we return, a local resident who moved here from New Orleans the day before it hit. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is WOSU 820 NPR News. At WOSU, listener feedback is very important. Your thoughts on the conversation some of us have been having across the radio and web matter a lot to us. We're creating an online audience advisory panel, and we're looking for at least 1,000 listeners who can help. If you have a moment, please go to wosu.org/survey and sign up and send us your thoughts. That's wosu.org/survey.
Support for WOSU comes from Columbus College of Art and Design. CCAD offers continuing education classes where you can update your creative career skills. Classes start September 13th. Information and online registration at www.ccad.edu.
73 degrees in downtown Columbus. Cloudy skies today, a high of 80. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 62. Sunny for tomorrow, and a high of 82. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Joining us now is Denise Trowbridge. You might recognize her name from the Columbus Dispatch, where she has worked off and on as a business reporter and most lately doing a great job covering the restaurant scene. I'm enjoying your stuff. Denise, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We met via email about 5 years ago when I was an editor at the Dispatch, and you sent me an email saying, hey, I'm a writer. I've lost my job because I lost my town. And you contacted me about work at the Dispatch, and I tried to line you up to work with me, but you know, you just couldn't happen. But it did happen eventually. You eventually were a business reporter for the Dispatch for a while. Tell us where you lived in New Orleans with your husband, why you left, and when you left.
We bought a house in the Irish Channel on Washington Avenue, probably in 2004. So we lived in New Orleans. You know, Eric actually was a transplant from San Francisco, so he didn't really understand the gravity of hurricanes and evacuations, whereas I had lived in New Orleans for about 10 years, so I had been through it multiple times. One thing that people tell me now is they don't understand why people didn't leave, but having lived there for 10 years and evacuated dozens of times, I really understand, because you get hurricane evacuation fatigue. It's expensive, it's time consuming. You sit in traffic for hours and hours, and then it doesn't hit, and really you just wasted time. You took days off work, you lost money, you know, that sort of thing. So that's why people don't leave. But aside from that, we were talking about, you know, Friday night right before Hurricane Katrina rolled in. It was just like any other Friday night. We had watched, you know, the Weather Channel. We saw that there was a giant hurricane in the Gulf, but every other hurricane had always at the last minute turned and hit Florida. I mean, that was the joke. It was like, oh, it's just going to hit Florida again. You know, we really don't have anything to worry about. So we went out on the town with our friends. We had dinner. We had drinks. And we were actually sitting in a bar at about 2 o'clock in the morning watching the Weather Channel. And we're like, oh, wouldn't it be funny if Katrina was the one that wiped us out? Because we actually had a friend named Katrina who, you know, wasn't very nice. So we thought it would be ironic if the storm that shared a name with her would be the one that did it. And, you know, we went home, we woke up on Saturday, and all of a sudden everything had changed. We turned on the television, and it was a more, you know, holy crap, this is going to be it. Like, you have to evacuate. And we were actually a little bit blindsided because, you know, they always turn and hit Florida, and we didn't expect there to be an evacuation order. We didn't expect it. And my husband, I said, pack the car, because I had evacuated during Hurricane George in 1998, and it was an absolute nightmare. You know, I was relatively new to New Orleans and hurricanes at that point, and I had never had to go through an evacuation, and I left at the last minute, and we literally sat in traffic for 12 hours and made it 5 miles. And at that point, it was a feeling of, if Hurricane George hits, like, we're just going to be sitting on the highway in a car. We are really in trouble. But during that storm, it took 2 days to get to Tennessee, which was the first free hotel room that we could find. And it was expensive and time consuming. And there were 5 of us in a car with 5 pets. And it was an absolute nightmare. So when that Saturday came and they were talking about maybe issuing an evacuation, I told my husband, I was like, I'm going to go gas up the car right now. It was about noon. And he was like, oh, we don't have to do it right now. We can wait. Let's just go have lunch. I'm like, no, we're doing it right now, because everybody else is waiting and having lunch and is going to go about their normal day. And I don't want to really stand in line for 3 hours at the gas station to get gas and then sit in traffic. So I gassed up the car, and we left. And, you know, the roads were clear. There was nobody evacuating. And we made it to Meridian, Mississippi, where we decided to spend the night. I'm going to back up a little bit and talk about packing the car, because usually when you evacuate, you know, if you decide that it's worth it, you just pack a weekend bag. Like, Eric actually took up half the trunk putting in golf clubs, because he's like, oh, well, this would be great. We'll have a long weekend at your parents' house. I'm going to play some golf, and, you know, it's great. So we literally had golf clubs and a duffel bag. And then at the last minute, I was like, I think that we should take the pets, and I think that I should take my computer, because just something about this, just like, I'm really nervous about this one. I don't know. Like, after Hurricane Ivan the year before, when we had evacuated, and it was September, it was about the same time, and that one turned and hit Florida, of course. But we had, you know, evacuated and left the pets and just taken the duffel bag, and it just seemed like too close of a call that time. So because of Hurricane Ivan, I was like, well, maybe we should really just take those things with us. So loaded up the cats and we loaded up the computer. And my husband made fun of me. He's like, why are you bringing that? And we don't need that. And then we left. So, you know, roads were clear. We stayed the night in Mississippi and then we landed at my parents' house on Sunday. And that's when, you know, we realized that it was really going to be the big one.
Tell us where your house was. Mm-hmm. Not everyone's familiar with the neighborhood you mentioned and what, you know, what happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, my house was actually about 4 or 5 blocks from the Mississippi River, uptown New Orleans. So if you're familiar with New Orleans, you know, there's the French Quarter, then there's downtown, then there's uptown. Mm-hmm. Washington Avenue is where Commander's Palace is, although I didn't live on that fancy of side of the street. So we were very close to the river.
Servants' Quarters.
Uptown,
so that,
yeah. Okay. Yeah, so it's actually a part of town that later was named the Isle of Denial because we were so lucky in that we avoided all the flooding. The flooding stopped about 18 blocks from our house, which we, of course, didn't know until a month later. But and it was a part of town that remained relatively unscathed, no flooding, just wind damage, which obviously you can fix with good roofing. So it was uptown New Orleans in the Irish Channel. So,
did you have friends who mm-hmm. had lost a lot?
Yes, actually. My best friends, they lived in Slidell, Louisiana, and their house flooded up to the second story, even though they had a raised house for the neighborhood. It was like on a 9-foot hill. But it was right by Lake Pontchartrain, so they lost pretty much everything and had to rebuild. So,
you didn't, though. Why did you decide to move?
Well, we didn't immediately. You know, once the storm had passed and it was just wind, you know, we were just like, okay, well, it's over and it's going to be okay, and we'll just go back and we'll just pick up our normal lives and go back to work and everything. But then it was like we just breathed a sigh of relief, and the next thing you know, we're watching the news, and there's a levee breach. And then it was wasn't so clear what was going to happen, and there was a lot of anxiety. So we just had to watch that happen and just be paralyzed for a couple of days watching the flooding and then watching, you know, the Superdome and the looting at the Walmart, which was actually only like a few blocks from our house, and, you know, not knowing what happened. And really, I think the decision was made when they decided to close the city, and they didn't know when they were going to open it again. Because at that point, when that happened, Eric and I both lost our jobs. We still had to pay a mortgage that was, you know, quite high. So it's like when you lose your job and you're stuck and you don't know if you still have a house, but you still have to pay the mortgage on the house. And, you know, I know the government had suggested that mortgage companies give you a little bit of leeway and not pay your mortgage, but that didn't happen. I don't know any bank or any friend of any who had a mortgage who actually got any, you know, free months. So,
when you said you lost your job, you mm-hmm. said you and Eric both lost your jobs. What did mm-hmm. that mean? It just you talked to your bosses and they said,
yeah,
we can't operate?
Yeah, we have to close. Yeah, that happened to most people.
You
that
worked
I know.
For a magazine?
Yes.
Was it?
Yeah. Yes. And ironically, the month before the storm, I'd written a story about that was supposed to run in the September issue about the city's plan and the police department's plan for, you know, in the event of a big one hitting. And they were very dicey about what their plan actually was, but they assured me they had one. So in retrospect, I'm thinking they didn't really have a good plan.
Who has a plan for that?
Who has a plan? So, I mean, I say we lost our jobs in that, you know, the magazine that I worked for folded. There weren't any small businesses that were going to advertise in a magazine after that for the foreseeable future. So all of a sudden I was out of work. And then, you know, my husband, his company was just another small mom and pop business. I mean, New Orleans is very small mom and pop businesses.
Right.
I mean, there's only one Fortune 500 company and all the other ones moved to Houston in the 80s and 90s. So
an interesting thing, the St. Bernard Parish that mm-hmm. was decimated was where a lot of the plumbers and mm-hmm. the woodworkers and the electricians lived. And mm-hmm. so when they were forced out, rebuilding became very difficult.
Oh, it was
for even someone like you.
Yeah. I mean, our house didn't flood, but we still had about $18,000 worth of damage. And, you know, we lost part of our roof and we had water damage resulting from that. And we also, you know, had trees uprooted and a FEMA truck actually backed into our porch and knocked off all the support beams for our balcony. And so, I mean, that was a nightmare. But finding a contractor who can do that work, it was almost impossible. I mean, we were so lucky because I had a friend who was a contractor and I had lost his number because everyone's phone number had changed because cell phone towers were down. And I mean, we had to immediately change our phone number in order to be able to do anything. It was impossible to find your friends. But I had a contractor, so I was lucky in that respect.
My guest is Denise Trowbridge. She lives in Central Ohio now. You might recognize her name. She's a writer for the Columbus Dispatch. But 5 years ago, she was a writer for a magazine in New Orleans where she had lived for about 10 years, and more lately with her husband, Eric, who was a newcomer to the area. Denise has been through a lot of these evacuations, but none quite like this. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page and contact us that way. What did you leave behind? When you left your house, you just walked away? You defaulted on the loan?
No.
Did it work? Did you manage to sell it? Or
we managed to sell it.
Wow.
It was a process. Once we had realized that the city was closing and that we weren't going to be able to go back because we were afraid we wouldn't be able to make a living there, you know, because we didn't know what was going to happen after the storm. The question was, what are we going to do about the house? I mean, bankruptcy was a real fear because, I mean, what do you do? We didn't even know at that point if it was still standing. It took at least a month for us to be able to actually see our house and see what the damage was. We didn't know if there was flooding. We didn't know if it was still standing. We didn't know if we were looted. I mean, we just didn't know, which was the worst part. So the day the city reopened, we were there, and we went back in, and it was actually very creepy because everything was exactly the same. I had vacuumed that morning and left the vacuum plugged into the wall, and it was still sitting where I had left it when I went to the gas station to fill up the car. So it was emotional because we were so lucky.
a little bit of survivors.
And that changed everything.
Yeah.
Because that's when I realized that it was going to be okay for us, that we were going to be able to sell the house and move on with our lives. You know, unlike a lot of our friends who, I have a friend who's still trying to sell their house that flooded, and it's been 5 years. So at that point when I saw the house and I saw the damage and I realized that it was fixable and that we were high and dry, that things were going to be okay. So that was emotional.
Who bought your house? I mean, at a certain
point,
a lot of people likes a challenge.
Yeah, well, actually, our neighborhood, and, you know, once again, I said it was the Isle of Denial, became a hot area for real estate because it was high and dry. And if you wanted to stay in New Orleans, you wanted a house that hadn't flooded in Katrina because you wanted to hope that it might not flood in the next storm.
Mm-hmm.
So anyone who was looking for a house and wanted to stay was looking in our neighborhood. So we actually were incredibly lucky. And there was a little bit of a real estate bubble after that. So we cashed in on that. I hate to say that, but but it worked out well for us. It did take time. It took about 6 months to sell our house. Like, we didn't sell it until March of 2006. And, of course, we were paying the mortgage during that time, living in my sister's basement with no job. So that was a little bit stressful. But
well, I would imagine there was a lot of stress.
Yes, it was.
Even though maybe you have a little survivor's guilt there, everything turned out all right for you, but you were wrenched from your home.
Yeah, you don't know that it's going to turn out well until the end. So it was very stressful. I have to say that was actually one of the worst 6 months of our marriage because we fought all the time and because it was so hard. And basically, as soon as the levees broke, dealing with the insurance companies became my full-time job. It was 8 to 9 hours a day on hold with insurance companies. I mean, they had not ever dealt with anything like this before, so they were even ill-prepared. So, you know, you would call and they would put you on hold or transfer you to somebody who was supposed to be handling your claim, and then they would hang up on you and you'd call back, and it was just an absolute, like, red tape nightmare. Like, it was just unbelievable. And I had actually finally gotten the name of my insurance adjuster. And I called him and he said, no, I just quit. I just can't handle it. It's too disorganized. I was like, really?
It was very stressful for a lot of those guys, too.
I'm like, it took me 2 months to get your phone number and you're supposed to be dealing with my house. So what do I do now? He's like, I don't know. And he hung up on me. I was
like, oh.
So that was a crying incident. But the next adjuster, who actually turned out to be my actual adjuster who I met in person, said that they were having a lot of problems and the insurance process was so slow because the insurance companies, you know, when you called, you gave them your new contact information, et cetera, but that wasn't being passed along to the insurance adjusters. They still had your home phone number when there was nobody there or no even house there for the phone to ring. And he told me that a lot of the insurance companies and the adjusters, they were told to just go leave notes on the doors of the houses and wait for people to call them. I'm like, everybody's gone. I mean, who's going to get that note? Everybody's evacuated. They're stranded. So that was really a difficult and time-consuming red tape process, and it took months. I mean, we didn't get our check for our home repairs until after we had sold the house.
Really?
We were actually very lucky because we had some money in the bank to actually start the repairs and finish them and pay for them because, you know, the damage was relatively minimal compared to, say, St. Bernard Parish. But if we hadn't had that money, I mean, I don't know what we would do. We would might still be paying a mortgage on that house because you can't sell a house that has hurricane damage that isn't fixed. So
you'd lived there for 10 years.
Mm-hmm.
You're very entrenched in the community. Mm-hmm. Why did you decide to stay away?
Well,
now you have family here.
I have
we
family
should say
here.
You had a place to go, and a lot of people didn't.
Mm-hmm.
But you did, so
I think that's a difficult question. I think that the thing that people don't realize about New Orleans is that the city was barely getting by before the storm. I mean, everything was broken there. The schools, the government, I mean, just getting anything done just was always swimming upstream. And at that point in my life, you know, being newly married and thinking about having a family, I was thinking, do I really want to raise them in a city that's limping along like this? So, you know, we had talked about leaving maybe before, but we hadn't made any active plans. So really just this kind of just made the decision for us that it was time to go because, you know, I don't know what future we saw for ourselves at that point. So
I know you went back this summer, I think.
Mm-hmm.
How was it?
Well, you know, people obviously are more concerned about the oil spill right now.
Right.
And I've been back multiple times.
Talk about a double whammy.
Yeah. It was pretty disturbing. But, I mean, I've been back to New Orleans at least once or twice a year every year since because I do miss my friends terribly. And it's not – I have to admit I've cried over it, you know,
sure.
Because I didn't expect that everything would be taken away overnight, literally. Like, it's a normal Friday night out with your friends, and the next day you don't know where they are. You don't know if they evacuated. You don't know anything. And it was very difficult. And, you know, obviously with the cell phone towers down, you can't call them on the phone to find out if they're okay or if they made it to their parents' house or, you know. But, I mean, I still feel like New Orleans is a huge part of me. And part of me would like to go back. But, you know, the future, I just don't think I could go through this again, really. We had actually considered moving to San Francisco after we landed here. And then I thought, the big one's going to hit there next. I said, there is no way that I can deal with FEMA checks and disasters anymore. Like, we just need to stay in Ohio because the worst thing that can happen here is a tornado. And then you just ride it out in your basement and it might take off somebody's roof. I'm like, I can deal with that. That's my kind of natural disaster with, like, popcorn in front of the TV. I can do that. But I can't do another earthquake or another hurricane or anything, especially at the time when I was thinking of having children. And I mean, we had to live in my sister's basement. Thank God for my sister. But it was really depressing to be 30 years old and homeless living in your sister's basement. And I was like, if I had kids, this would be 10 times worse. So.
And now you have two.
And now I have two. But they hopefully will never have to go through this. So.
Well, thanks for coming today and sharing it with us. I appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
I'm glad you stayed.
Well, Ohio is deliciously boring, but everybody here is nice, so I can't complain.
Much less so with you here.
Yeah.
Okay. That was Denise Trowbridge. She lives in Central Ohio. She writes for the Columbus Dispatch, if you recognize the name. We'll be back in a few minutes to talk with another documentary maker, this one a graduate of OSU's Kiplinger program at the John Glenn School of Public Affairs. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
This is Terry Gross, the host of Fresh Air, and I'm on a roll. It's been more than a year since a guest walked out on one of my interviews, but honestly, by the time you hear this, my luck may have run out. Tune in and see on the next Fresh Air.
And Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon. On today's edition of Fresh Air, Scott Simon, the host of NPR's Weekend Edition, has a new memoir about his two daughters who he and his wife adopted from China. It's called Baby, We Were Meant for Each Other. And that discussion is on the next Fresh Air at noon, right here on WOSU 820.
Support for WOSU comes from Thrifty Airport Valet Parking, a valet service for business and leisure travelers that takes you in your car to curbside check-in at Port Columbus, 614-237-5800 or thriftycolumbus.com.
Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it. Daily, biweekly, or monthly, go to WOSU.org/email and sign up for one of our e-newsletters. 74 degrees in downtown Columbus at 11:41 this morning. Cloudy skies, a little bit of sunshine, and a high of 80 degrees today. Partly cloudy tonight, a low of 62. Sunny for Tuesday, and a high of 82 degrees. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues. This is WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We are talking about Katrina 5 years later. And joining us now is Chandra Davis. She is a former Kiplinger Fellow at the John Glenn School of Public Affairs at Ohio State University. She is an award-winning journalist whose work has appeared in People, Essence, Ebony, Newsweek, Upscale, Heart and Soul, and Atlanta magazines. She is also a native of New Orleans. Welcome to the show, Chandra.
Hi. Just a slight correction. I don't want anybody to think I got married yet. It's Chandra Thomas.
Oh, I'm sorry, Chandra. That's probably my fault today. Apologize about that.
It's a Monday. You're always forgiven on a Monday.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, you're right. There it is on my dummy board, too, Chandra Thomas. Okay.
I remember that board.
My cheater board. Your project is the product of your Kiplinger Fellowship at Ohio State last year. You were on the program last year, not to talk about it, but you did promise to come back and talk about your project. It focuses on the rebuilding efforts of a historic African-American neighborhood in New Orleans. I want to hear a bit from it first before we get started. This scene features a victim in Pontchartrain Park. She speaks on how after 5 years, Katrina still has a terrible impact on the district and her personally. And this is from Chandra Thomas's project from John Glenn. Here you go.
They think it's been 5 years that we should be past. You know, all that old Hurricane Katrina, you know, I'm tired of hearing about Hurricane Katrina, you know. But they don't realize that it changed so many people's lives, you know. It's a hard thing.
It changed your life as well, right, Chandra?
Absolutely. I'm a native of New Orleans, but at the time of Katrina, I was living in Atlanta. And it's a really interesting story, but I was actually in New Orleans the weekend of Katrina. We were supposed to be doing a family surprise party for my grandmother, who was at that time turning 77 years old. And we always have this joke that, you know, we were doing a surprise party, but Katrina surprised us. And our party obviously got canceled. Mm-hmm. And many of my family members had to relocate to Atlanta for several years, including my grandmother, who lived with me for, you know, 2 out of 3 years in Atlanta. So definitely impacted a lot of lives, including my own.
Your film, it's about Pontchartrain Park. It's a neighborhood. Tell us about it. It's historical. Why?
Yeah. Basically, as you mentioned, I was a 2010 Kiplinger Public Affairs Journalism Fellow at The Ohio State University. And what we do is we spend 6 months on campus producing multimedia projects. And mine turns out to be a series of short videos about Pontchartrain Park, which is a historic African-American community that was actually built in the Jim Crow era of Louisiana in the late 50s. And it's one of the oldest planned African-American communities in the country and the oldest planned suburban African-American community in New Orleans. And so it's kind of a different take on the very media overblown image of the Katrina victim as sort of being sort of a destitute person who was a renter, who was really heavily dependent maybe on public assistance and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Pontchartrain Park had a 98% home ownership rate for nearly 50 straight years. And was actually about to turn 50 years old, like months before Katrina actually hit. And it was an all-black community. It was built on a golf course. had a ballpark. We had two historically black colleges. And we just really called it the Leave It to Beaver lifestyle. And these are people who worked all their lives, paid their taxes, paid their insurance, like your previous guest mentioned. And when Katrina hit, many of them were left were left homeless. And still 5 years later, a lot of these residents are not back in their homes.
And that seems unlikely. So what was the makeup of their circumstance that left them like that, that kept them away for so long?
As you'll see in my project, which, by the way, is premiering on thegrio.com starting on Wednesday, you will see that many of these residents did not get the insurance money that they thought they would get. They had a false safety net that they would be getting insurance money. In fact, this effort that I'm really highlighting mm-hmm. is being spearheaded by the actor Wendell Pierce, who's the star of HBO's Tremé and The Wire. And even his own mother said their family paid their homeowner's insurance for nearly 50 straight years, and they only got something to the effect of like a month or two of like a daily sort of per diem for, they said that Katrina was a 14-day disaster as far as 14 days you could not be in the city, and that's what they got for 50 years. And then now, you know, there were these programs that were created like the Road Home program mm-hmm. and some other, you know, there's a lot of funding available for elevating your house. And if you're senior, if you do, you know, it's a lot of like criteria that you have to fit, and, you know, all these different little nooks and crannies that you have to fit in to get this money. And while all that's being worked out, even the people who did get money from the Road Home program, they're living off of that money right now. And so if you got $30,000 5 years ago and you're 75 years old and you don't work, then that's your income. And so a lot of these people are still they're living in rental properties and they can't afford to rebuild their home. And that's really where the frustration is. They feel that the government has made it extremely difficult for them to actually get the money that was promised to them. And in fact, I read a report that only 77% of the funding, the several billion dollars that was given to, actually was 77% of the emergency community development block grants that were approved for housing needs. Only 77% has been spent. And they said right now, at this point, 5 years later, over $3 billion is unspent. And so a lot of people feel like, why isn't this money getting to the residents?
Mm-hmm. My guest is Chandra Thomas. She's a journalist, and she has a new video out. And Chandra, we'll post a link to that so folks can get to it on Wednesday when it becomes public. I want to listen to another scene now from your project. It talks about how moving forward in Pontchartrain Park is a very slow process.
I want my mom to get back in the house, but to have some peace in her own home, not in somebody else's, not paying anybody rent because she had a house that was paid for.
To be quite frank, you're dealing with a public sector. And, you know, there's certain bureaucracies, you have to do certain environmental issues. And once you find there is an environmental issue that needs to be cleared up, the public sector, to be quite honest, it's a little slower than the private sector.
You know, we're still surviving. And I know that eventually things are going to work out. We'll be back in the house again.
Chandra, you mentioned the actor who's leading the charge there. What did he made the point in the film that they had what it takes to rebuild themselves, to do it alone. Who's they and why did they have to do it alone?
Well, basically what happened was Wendell Pierce is a native of the Pontchartrain Park area. Mm-hmm. And basically he realized years after the storm that Pontchartrain Park was experiencing the second lowest return rate, only behind the Lower Ninth Ward, which has gotten a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. So he decided to, you know, bring some residents together, and he has joined forces with several African-American-owned businesses, one of which is SRP Development, which is based in Columbus, Ohio, which is headed by a man named Paul Taylor. And he is part of the rebuilding process. And he is, so Wendell Pierce has gotten this group of people together, and they've also created partnerships with the government entities, one of which is the New Orleans Redevelopment Authority. And they're basically deciding to rebuild the community, you know, basically on their own terms. They say, we're not going to wait for the government or outside forces to come in. You know, we are strong. We're intelligent. As he says, we have the intellectual property and the resources to do it ourselves. And he says that in my series. And so basically what they've done is they've created a community development corporation, which they call their Pontchartrain Park CDC. And they have joined forces with the Neighborhood Association, and they have come up with a plan to rebuild this community. And part of the development is they're also building some brand new green homes. When I say green, I mean energy efficient, you know, LEED certified.
Silver.
LEED certified silver, you know, geothermal loops, optional solar panels. And these homes have a annual utility rate, get this, $300 to $400 a year minus water. So they are really coming together and saying, not only are we going to rebuild, we're going to, you know, take the lead. And they've actually become the lead model for the city as far as rebuilding. So it's really a great story. And I was really excited to find a Columbus, Ohio connection.
Yeah, it's funny how that works, isn't it?
Yeah.
How did you decide, when did you know there was a story here? Because with a story, you want sort of like a beginning, a middle, and an end kind of a thing. Like, how did you know that?
Well, I think, you know, like that, like I mentioned, the Columbus aspect really surprised me, because here I am, you know, first time in life in Columbus, Ohio, doing this Kiplinger Public Affairs Journalism Fellowship. And everyone kept saying, you should check into what's going on in Pontchartrain Park. You should check into that. And so here I go. I email the Pontchartrain Park CDC, and I said, hi, I'm in Columbus, Ohio, and I'm doing this fellowship. And I get an email back in like 15 minutes from Paul Taylor saying, hey, I'm in Columbus and I would love to talk to you about this. And I thought, wow, who knew that the community that I grew up in was being rebuilt partially by a company based out of Columbus, Ohio.
You know, when
that was really important.
When I watched it this morning, I didn't get that he was from Columbus. I might have missed that, but he grew up there as well in Pontchartrain Park.
No,
okay.
Actually, Paul Taylor did not. He's a native. Actually, he's a native of Columbus.
Okay.
And his office is SRP Development right there on Leonard Avenue. I know you know where that is.
Mm-hmm. But was he in the film?
Yes, he is.
Okay.
He's the guy who talks about the insurance and how there was a false safety net.
Okay.
He was the one that also mentioned the 98% home ownership rate.
All right.
And he's you know, he has his own company, but he is, you know, pulled into this initiative as well. And he actually got involved through Congressman Maxine Waters, who basically sent out a call to action asking African American owned companies to get involved in the rebuilding of New Orleans. And that's how that all happened.
You know, my guest earlier, Janice Trowbridge, she made the point that how lucky she was that she had a place to go. You know, a lot of people from Pontchartrain Park, middle class, retired, they had families elsewhere. A lot of them had places to go. There weren't too many people that were left homeless or really high and dry, were there?
Well, I think a lot of us, like myself, mm-hmm. Had moved away. So many people did have relatives in other places. But I think what I really wanted to get across to, you know, in my project is that, can you imagine, you know, I just have so much respect for people like my grandmother, who, by the way, passed away in Atlanta, waiting to get back in her home. She actually was supposed to go back to see her remodeled home and got sick the day before and never recovered. And so I really wanted to talk about the fact that these are people. Most, one-third of Pontchartrain Park residents were senior citizens, and most of them were over the age of 70.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine you've worked all your life, you put your kids through school, you paid your taxes, your house was paid off, you're living on a fixed income,
mm-hmm.
and now at 77, 80, and 80 plus, you are homeless and you have nowhere to live and you don't even get to spend your last years in your home. And these are the same people who are still fighting to get back in their homes. And the reality is most of these Pontchartrain Park residents, they don't have 5 and 10 and 15 years for this community to come back. And right now the return rate is about 55%. So just over half of the residents of Pontchartrain Park are back, which means over 500 other households are not back. And so, and many of them probably will not be able to come back because many of them probably are, you know, just too old and, you know, they may be sick, they may have health issues, and they may not be able to come back. And some of them, you know, really, this really zapped the energy from them. You know, this is the place that they built up. And how many people can say lived in a community with 98% home ownership for nearly five straight decades? Mm-hmm. So this was a stable community, and they're in some ways they're not faring any better than someone else who did not own a home. And so that's what we're really trying to get across with this project, is that this is what the American dream: own a home, you know, put your kids through school. And is this what you deserve in your golden years?
Mm-hmm. It was a success story.
Yeah.
Until Katrina. What are they going to do if they can't get people to return to that neighborhood? Are they going to develop it and try to bring new people in?
That's what they're doing. Basically, what's great about the Pontchartrain Park CDC is that what they're doing is they are helping residents get back. And even if they don't want, you know, if they want to rebuild their home, they're kind of having a one-stop shop where you can sit down and say, let's look at what you can qualify for. And this is what people need, mm-hmm. because as your previous guest mentioned, you know, you're on hold and you're calling and you have to email and you have to send paperwork. And there's, you know, a part of my project where one woman and you played some of her interview, Sharon Hartley DeLay. She mentioned that she's trying to help her mother, who's, you know, trying to get back into her home. Her mother is 84 years old, and she says, I bring the paper back, and then they say, oh, we didn't have that paper, and I have to go bring it back. And just this constant cycle. And so what the Pontchartrain Park CDC is doing is they're helping residents do that. And then there are lots of people who've always wanted to live in Pontchartrain Park. Mm-hmm. Pontchartrain Park, you know, has produced, you know, two of the city's mayors. It's produced Wendell Pierce. It's produced trumpeter Terrence Blanchard, and the current EPA chief, Lisa Perez Jackson. So this is a strong community. So a lot of people are saying, hey, this is my shot to get in the Pontchartrain Park. Since they have all these homes that they're trying to get filled up, let's move in. So what they're doing now is they're doing a really strong push saying, hey, if you want to live in Pontchartrain Park, you can get one of these new energy-efficient green homes. Now, I will say on the flip side, though, for those who already own property there, you know, you're basically having to essentially buy another house.
Chandra, we've run out of time. I'm so sorry. Enjoy talking to you again, and best luck with the project. Mm-hmm. I know it's very close to your heart. I appreciate it. Thanks to my guests as well, Denise Trowbridge. She's still with us. Thanks for staying with us, Denise. That's all the time we have. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.